Welcome to VCR, Vintage Cinema Rewind. We're bringing old movies to new viewers. I'm Blake.
I'm Jason.
And where are we heading today? We're heading to Roadhouse, where they have to sweep up the eyeballs after closing.
Classic, yeah. This is it's an intense one in that respect, for sure.
I love that quote from this movie, because every time I hear it, I'm like, who came up with the idea of having to sweep eyeballs up after closing?
Yeah. And it does have that classic bar fight breaks out every night kind of thing. Like, that's the story.
That's actually one of my favorite parts. So before I get into all of that stuff, we are talking about the 1989 version of Roadhouse, the classic original Patrick Swayze vehicle. It's being remade. We've actually already had the remake out at this point. And so, yeah, so this is the spoiler-full discussion of that 1989 version. If you haven't seen this movie before, go check out the spoiler-free discussion, our primer episode of Roadhouse, to see if this movie is for you or not, and when and where to check it out and all that fun stuff.
Yeah, and a little intro to the characters and everything there.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. Like, now we're going to dive full-on into spoiler discussion. And yeah, I guess what we were talking about before I got on this kind of point is just some of the fights and like the ridiculousness of this bar. And that's kind of like one of the insane points of this plot, right? Is that like, as soon as somebody starts fighting in this bar, like 100% of the patrons just like start going at it. And it's like to seriously injure everybody else in this bar.
Yeah. You use everything. I don't know how they have furniture. Like, they must have a restocking crew just for furniture every night.
Yeah. It's insane.
Yeah.
All glasses are just completely obliterated. Like, in the opening scene of the movie, when Tilghman convinces Dalton that he needs to come work for him for an upfront fee of $5,000 and then $500 a night.
Yeah.
Like, you kind of understand pretty quickly why he would pay such a premium. And then you immediately think, why the hell is this guy even trying to run this bar when he's spending thousands of dollars on tables every night?
Yeah. I did the calculation on how much Dalton is worth in today's money. $12,500 up front and
right.
$1,251 a night.
Yeah, it's somewhere in the ballpark of like an annual salary, like if he's working most nights, of almost $500,000, right?
Yeah, which makes no sense. But in this world, it does make sense because bar fights are absolutely insane. And he
because
is the
bar
owner.
Is everything.
Yeah, he is the only cooler in the business who is worth his salt.
If you think of the Roadhouse world as being in a similar vein as like the John Wick world, in that, you know, like the bouncer world is just like this like deep, like, you know, stocked, fully fleshed out idea of this universe that we live in, and bouncing is everything. And like right off the bat, like Tilghman, what does he say? He's like, oh, I recently came into some money and I really want to have a go at it here with this bar. And then after the first night of seeing all the fights and everything, you're like, why, man?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
What possible reason do you have to invest in this show?
Yeah, it has to be a whole other universe. Yeah.
Yeah. It's taking place in a different realm of existence. That's for sure. And that's kind of the thing as well that is very interesting about this world, is that we get to the movie shows us several times, like especially in those opening scenes where Dalton's kind of flushing away his old life at that really cool music club that we see at the beginning.
Yeah.
You know, establishing himself in the new town, right? Like, you know, it's really cool because it kind of shows us stuff and then it pays off a little bit later. Like,
mm-hmm.
The best example is when he throws away his car, right? And he goes and gets his like Beamer. And
yeah.
You're like, why is this guy like just so like nonchalant about throwing away a car? And then he gets to the new town and he goes and gets like a new car, a new old car, basically,
yeah.
Right? Like that 1965 Buick
Riviera. Yeah.
You know, I gotta shout out a cool old car when I see one like that. That's a really very unique car as well that I really appreciated, because it's like one of the only cars of that generation that had what they called the clamshell headlights, like those covers that you actually press a button to open and close. With him setting up and going and buying that car, even though we know he has like a sick Beamer, then going and get like those old crappy tires, you're like, what? Like, why is this guy doing all of this? Like, none of it makes any sense at that point in time.
Yeah, until the first night.
Yeah, until the first night where everything goes to shit and Dalton goes to hop in his car to go home and there's a freaking knife in his tires and they're all slashed, right? And then you're like, oh, this suddenly makes a lot of sense why this guy has this kind of practice that he has established at this point in time, right?
And this reputation, like he's pure professional, like he understands it and he's getting paid well for it. You see the Mercedes where like on his own time, that's what he drives. And then the rest of the time he knows to make sure that everybody in the bar sees his old beater and they're all targeted. And he's like, oh, not again.
And that's part of also, like you said, like his whole like personality as well. It's just kind of like, like nonchalant about everything. Yeah. And it's like, and that's kind of one of the first parts of his code, right? Like, you know, again, this is kind of like a man with a code kind of movie. And his primary codes is be nice. You see that throughout the movie. Like he just lets shit roll off his shoulder until later in the film when he gets to his breaking point. But, you know, that's something that he lets people have their little victories as long as at the end of the day, he wins that war, right? Like it's all of these like little battles and he can see, he's seeing the bigger picture of all of this.
Yeah. And like, that's where his whole philosophical guy angle actually, like it balances his like bouncer attitude and everything. And it interweaves with everything. Like he's a complex character for such a ridiculous movie.
Yeah, and that's almost the paradox of this film is that, like I said, like this is one of my favorite good, bad movies, and it's completely insane. And like the only thing I will ever harp on about this movie is the screenplay of it. But at the end of the day, like it's also surprisingly tightly written. Everything kind of makes sense in this world.
Yeah, I wish I watched the... I don't know if there is an extended version because this movie has a bunch of cuts. Even just watching the original trailer, there's like 5 scenes that they cut just from the trailer. So how many got cut from the full movie? The editing team may have done a really good job just to pull it all in and make it as tight as possible for how ridiculous, again, like the whole plot is.
Well, and on that note as well, like I did some research on that, and the original cut of this film was something like 3 hours and 20 minutes long.
I'd watch
and
it
so that yeah I think that you're right. I think you nailed it, that whoever was editing and cutting this film down really did think about like, what does this movie want to be at its absolute core? Like where is this movie's heart, and how do we just really lean into that as much as possible? That's kind of where the first like, why does this movie work for me come into play, is that like the world feels like really lived in. Like we understand who Dalton is. Like there's a deep cast of characters here as well. Like as soon as we're introduced to the Double Deuce and all of Dalton's co-workers and underlings, like I feel instantly charmed by everybody, right? And I feel like I know all of these people, and I feel like these people are all just like actually like real people living in this world.
Yeah, especially since we're both from small towns, like there are clear delineations between the people who are like just genuine good people and they're doing their job and living their life and everything. And then there's those fucking assholes, and he just kicks them out right away. And he's like, I see who you are because I've been here.
Yeah. That's a great point, right? Like we've all dealt with those kind of people, like, especially in our teenage years where, you know, maybe somebody's like skimming off the top where you're working, or, you know, somebody's selling drugs out the back or something like that kind of stuff. Right. Like it's funny because this film shows that stuff, and like as an audience it's kind of exciting and thrilling, but it's also something that if you experienced it, it was like it actually does happen.
Oh yeah.
And it's annoying. But like that's a part of the reality, right? It's like this is a complex community that feels very lived in.
Yeah, and it's like kind of like an underworld area where you see a lot of genuine good people who like have great solid friendships, even though they're all like stuck in this area that kind of sucks.
Yeah.
You see how close Dalton and Jeff Healey's character are.
Yeah.
Like instantly, like they're like bros. As soon as they see each other, they're like, hey, we've both been through it.
They know each other. Like they kind of, and that's part of what I, again, this is like one of those script things where I'm like, so you're telling me that Jeff Healey and Dalton at some point have crossed paths here, but why is Jeff Healey, as talented as he is, decided to make a go at it at the Double Deuce as well? And I guess, you know, there's probably some sort of answer where Tilghman has, like, also paid them a bunch of money, but, yeah. Like, Tilghman is, like, the worst businessman ever.
I know. How much are the drinks at these places? Because back then, they would have been, like, 15 cents a beer or something like
maybe that. Maybe that's why everybody's so mad all the time, is the beers cost, like, $10.
Oh, yeah, maybe.
You know, what if the beers are costing me, like, 20 bucks, like, in today's money as well? Like, I better be getting a show every time I show up, too. Like,
yeah, yeah.
Jesus. Yeah, and then there's some more, like, world building. Like, this movie goes out of its way to give us explanations for things.
Yeah, which is crazy because there's such good writing in, like, those concepts are, like, the themes are deep, but then the dialogue, like, when one guy comes back to the bar and Dalton's like, sorry, we're closed. And the guy's like, then what are all these people doing here? He's like, drinking and having a good time. And the guy's like, that's why we're here. And he's like, you're too stupid to have a good time.
I almost picked that scene as my one scene to sell the movie.
Yeah.
Because that, again, that's a very quotable scene. It's a great action scene. Doc shows up as well. And so, like, it's got her in it briefly.
And, like, but it's just, there's like, a boot
one
knife.
Of those line readings. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the, like, the shining boot knife and everything. Like, it's just completely absurd, but it's just so much fun that, like, you just kind of forgive it.
Yeah, and, like, you see, like, him clock the knife, like, instantly. He's like, that guy's got a knife that comes out of the toe of his boot, which is ridiculous. And then, for real life. Then you also have, like, the big, larger bouncer who's, like, he's become a professional. Right. Since the first talk, the first night, and, like, he's actually, like, learning from Dalton. And so, like, you have that deeper connection thing, and then just a funny-ass line.
I love that Dalton has, like, this deep ingrained code that he lives by. And so the code is never underestimate your opponent, expect the unexpected. And they're all pretty, like, self-explanatory, but they also do generally make sense, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Especially when dealing with a bunch of drunk people who are, like, emotionally, you know, sexually charged, whatever, like, they're drunk,
they're all pumped up.
They're all pumped up. Yeah, exactly. Like, don't underestimate what somebody's prepared to do in this situation. Take it outside. Never start anything inside the bar unless it's absolutely necessary. Like, yeah, obviously, duh. Like, that's a great way to start a barroom brawl, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
And the last one, just be nice, like, kill them with kindness kind of thing. Like, if you take everything personally in this job, like, you have to recognize that this is just a job. Like, this is just what you do. If you take everything personally, then, like, they're going to feed into that, right? Yeah. Like, if you just kill them with kindness, like, you're going to de-escalate so many situations.
Yeah, yeah. Like, his quote when someone asks him is, like, if somebody gets in your face and calls you a cocksucker, I want you to be nice. Ask him to walk, be nice. If he won't walk, walk him, but be nice. If you can't walk him, one of the others will help you, and you'll both be nice. I want you to remember that it's a job. It's nothing personal. And, like, he's teaching this to these people for the first time, and, like, they actually, you see them grow into that, and, like, it's, like, again, passing the torch, because Garrett passed it to him. He passes it on.
He's spreading the good word. He's, like, the messiah of bouncers.
Yeah, yeah.
Actually, technically, I think that he's a disciple or something, and Wade is the messiah.
No.
He's the messiah!
Sorry, Wade is Moses, and he's the messiah.
Nice. We got to have multiple messiah.
Yeah.
What is, I guess, the multiple of messiah is just messiah.
Yeah, it is.
But why is the band at the training session?
Oh, yeah, yeah. They're just hanging out all the time.
I'm going to rip up the script as much as I love this movie throughout our discussion here. From point number one, from first watch, I've always been like, why does Dalton have the band and all of the like bartenders and everybody here for this discussion?
Yeah.
always just like blown my mind. Anyway, the other part of all of the opening scenes here, the world building and everything, is when we get our first kind of introduction to Brad Wesley. And the way that he's introduced is actually by Dalton going and getting a farm apartment rental in top of this guy's barn. As a side note, I would actually die in that apartment because the amount of hay would just like obliterate me.
Oh, I thought you meant you'd die because it's like perfect. I want to live there.
It's so charming. Like you got to give it to Emmett the farmer.
Yeah.
Like he has built a nice little like bachelor apartment up there.
Yeah, and it's like modern for that time.
Yeah, this is one of like the dumbest lines of this movie. That's when Brad Wesley shows up in his helicopter and, you know, he just like flies around and kind of like messes with Emmett. And Emmett's like, I swear that he does that just to piss me off. Yeah. And like, as soon as he said that, I'm like, yeah, obviously, man. Like that he's menacingly looking at you and like driving this thing all over the place. Like,
yeah, yeah. My line is Travis McKenna is like the fat bouncer that he's like that's learning. Just the way he says, like, are you kidding? Like, it's like so cartoony. Like, so it's like he's making fun of the script in the moment, but I think he was trying hard. It was just so funny. There's so many lines, and we'll keep bringing them up because there's too many.
I do want to bring up Emmett one more time in these early scenes, because there's a scene where Dalton is doing kind of like yoga Tai Chi in the morning outside of the farm. You know, he's sweating it up, like he's shirtless, like
glistening.
You know, like he's glistening. Brad Wesley is kind of menacingly watching him across the lake at his like big mansion. And Emmett's like just like staring at him. And the scene just kills me every time because Emmett just kind of like brushes his hair back at the end of the scene, and it's like almost like he's saying like, god damn, that's one pretty boa.
Yeah.
I don't know if you noticed that, but I was like,
man, I was laughing so much in this movie that I probably noticed. I don't remember, but yeah,
that's like, that's, I don't know,
just, I'm gonna look for that scene again.
It's like what all of us are thinking. It's just like, you know, like it's like one of those first scenes that like he's really being sexualized in this film. Like,
yeah,
this film knows that Patrick Swayze is like the sex symbol of the
80s. Oh yeah.
And you know, again, like I said in the primer episode, this is coming off of Dirty Dancing. Like, Patrick Swayze and this movie both know who and what he represents, and they just go hard into that. Like, we get his ass shot in the morning, like in that same scene.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
He's just as sexualized as every female in this movie.
Yeah, yeah.
If not more, debatably.
I agree. And like, Dirty Dancing was like purely for the ladies, basically. This one is like almost all for the men, but then it has a little bit of that.
It understands what it's trying to do, and it understands like that it's playing with these like hyper sexualized tropes.
Yeah.
And it doesn't shy away from it. And that's what, again, why does this movie work? It works because it knows what it wants to be. It understands that Patrick Swayze is a sex symbol coming from that. And so it knows that it needs to appeal to the female audience who made Patrick Swayze such a star.
Yeah.
But that it also is just like such a kick-ass movie as a guy that you're just like so invested in it as well, kind of thing.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, it's balanced enough. Yeah.
And it's really well directed as well at this point. Like, I actually wrote that down in these scenes. I was like, you know, like, this movie is putting these characters and like framing everything really well. Like, the fight scenes are all framed really well. Like, there's good fight choreography here. Like, I just, you know, really appreciating things as I'm watching them.
And yeah, just like they're setting up so many things too. So like, as they're introducing him again, like, to finish off kind of these early scenes, when he walks in initially, they're like, oh shit, like they recognize him, or like one of them recognizes them, and then they pass it. They're like, oh, it's that guy. And they're like, no, it's that guy. And they're like, that's the best damn cooler in the business. And then one guy's like, I heard like that he has a legend about him. One of them's like, I heard he ripped a guy's throat out. Like, at the beginning of the movie.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Which it's is like great. Touch of death. Like,
yeah.
They highlight this idea of him and just, build the lore of who Dalton is. And also, like, because we only see Dalton as this like extraordinarily calm and collected person, it kind of just like builds up the not only the mythology of him and what he means in this world, but also like that maybe there's a dark side to Dalton as well, right? That if pushed to a point, he will do things that like no ordinary human being should be able to even do.
There's this one part where he's like, you fuck with him, like you seal your fate. People know about all this stuff, but then we see him and he's like calm and does Tai Chi and like he's like past that and he's grown. But then like you get flashes of that. And that's the whole point of the movie, is like this guy has dealt with some shit and he's trying his best. He's dealing with it very well, considering. And he's also like, he can't leave this space because he needs to be like close to that like internal struggle because he doesn't know anything else.
Yeah, there's like this pride that he has in himself and like his code and everything. And Brad Wesley is just like so comically evil. And just like Brad Wesley makes this personal and more personal as the film goes on, right? Like,
yeah,
if he had just like sat back and let Dalton do his thing,
there'd be a great bar in town
that he could extort too, right?
Yeah. Like, for more money than he was.
The whole thing around Brad Wesley and like the fact that his nephew was working there and skimming off of the top, like Wesley, as an uncle here, sometimes you just got to chalk up your dumb nephew as a dumb nephew and I don't know, give him like some dumb job, like driving him around daily or something like that. Like, I don't know, like, you know,
yeah,
that's the kicking off point of this, is that his dumb nephew gets fired and like there's that the knife fight, right? Like, you know, when the scene where the lawyer shows up at the Double Deuce and they're threatening them to get his job back and then everybody pulls a knife, like every shoe is just immediately going for first degree murder, like so hard so quickly in this movie.
100%.
It's insane like how quickly things go from 0 to 100.
There were probably like 3 or 5 quotes in that one scene that like I want to reference but I don't remember because there's all these other ones, because that was a fun scene.
It's a great scene. And then, you know, like that's how he eventually meets Elizabeth, or Doc as we know her throughout the film. Also, one of those moments where she's like, you know, there's that little bit of lore building where she's like, so you carry your own medical reports around.
I was just going to say that. Yes. Like, do you always carry your medical record around with you? And Dalton's like, saves time.
It's like, that's one of those things where it's like, you know what? Honestly, pre-internet era, like, that's not the worst idea.
Oh, ever, yeah.
Right? Like, and I can't imagine in the new Roadhouse that being, like, a plot point where he just, like, has all his medical records with him. Because, like, why would you ever need that?
I bet he'll have a QR code with his medical record attached to it, like, tattooed on him.
Oh, jeez.
That'd be great.
And then we get the, like, one of the dumbest lines of the entire movie where he's like, pain don't hurt, and there's just like no explanation, no deeper like thing behind that quote at all. Like, that's all he says, it's just like, pain don't hurt. And it's like, where I want to hear the philosophical meaning behind that. Where's the second part of this sentence?
He doesn't, I think, in the same scene say nobody wins a fight.
Yeah, there's that point too. Yeah,
I don't know why I'm giving him a country accent, because he's just like, nobody wins a fight.
Yeah. And so, yeah, sexy doctor lady shows up and they instantly fall in some sort of romantic thing together.
Entanglement, yeah.
She just so happens to be the niece of Red, who owns the general store across the street.
It was the body parts shop where he went to get the tires. And then when somebody threw a stop sign through his Riviera's front window, he also went back there to get that replaced. Yeah.
I love that this is a low-key movie about uncles. there are two official uncles in this movie with Red and Brad. I'll even throw in like unofficial uncle status for Wade.
Yeah, I agree.
There you go. This may be the only uncle movie in existence, but it's a very heavily important uncle and niece nephew movie.
Yeah, exactly. I like it.
The first time it popped up, I was like, okay. And then the second time it popped up and I was like, wait a second. They just did the same thing.
Yeah.
This is at the point in time when Doc is presented. It's like, again, why does this movie work so well? It's because everybody is just like a 10 out of 10, like so sexy in this small little town. Everybody is just like an absolute sex symbol, or they're white trash. Like that fat guy who works for Brad Wesley, who just like always is wearing like coveralls and stuff. I'm like, that guy's like just pure trailer trash.
I love his demise at the end.
It's just so absurd.
Yeah.
He just, for like 20 seconds, watches as a like
stuffed polar bear.
He falls on top of him.
Yeah. Yeah. And it like knocks him out somehow.
Yeah. The first time I saw that, I was like, so did like the polar bear's head just like cave in his stomach? Like, how, like, why did he die? And then he gets up at the end.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so ridiculous. It's around this scene as well that I'm like, what is Brad Wesley's grip on this town? Like, how does he have such a tight grip on this town? Because we see that he's like extorting Red, and it's like, is he a loan shark? Like, does he just extort people because he can't? Like, how, like, what is the premise of this, right? Oh,
I remember. So basically it was like a shitty town before, and he came in with his like, I don't know if he had some kind of like manufacturing facility. Like he had like farms or something like that. And he's like, I'm going to start a fund to renew the city and like make everything nice. But he used that fund for himself and he just got rich off it. So it was like a racket. He was extorting everybody, but he did it in like the name of the city, and like had like probably like a committee, and they're like, oh, let's put in a new water fountain here or whatever. So that's very similar to Reacher. Have you seen the new Reacher show?
Yes, I've only seen season one.
Same. Yeah, like same concept.
Yeah, okay, that's fair. Yeah, I see what you mean.
It's apparently common in America or something like that.
Every small town has its like
beneficiary.
Dirtbag, beneficiary. And trust fund nephew.
Yeah.
Who works at the bar.
Who thinks he's a badass, but actually isn't.
Oh, and like on the note of Brad too, like watching him just like casually destroy this town without any sort of repercussion is like just completely insane. Like he blows up Red's place.
Yeah.
And you know what? Like, okay, there's probably ways to commit arson that make it hard to trace it back to Brad Wesley.
Especially at like an auto parts store that has a bunch of oil and whatnot inside. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I mean, it blew up pretty hard. Like, okay, maybe, some sort of fire breaks out or something, but whatever. But then like the middle of the day, like monster truck scene is just like so insane.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I was flabbergasted at that scene. I was like, no, like I had to write this down. I was like, no, you can't just do that, Brad. I know your name is Brad, but you can't be that much of an asshole.
And it's so funny because it almost feels like it shouldn't be in this movie, this scene. Like it takes place in a area of town that we've never been in, with some characters that, you know, we've just the scene before been like very briefly introduced to, and not even like really introduced to. It's just like there's a couple guys in town who are just talking about Red's store afterwards and are like debating, you know, trying
standing
to convince
up.
Red not to leave. Yeah. Yeah.
Standing up to the to Brad and whatnot. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And then immediately after, the guy who owns the local Ford dealership just has his dealership absolutely destroyed by a monster truck. I think that it would be a scene that would be very easy to cut for story purposes, but they did drop like, I don't remember how much they spent on that scene. It was something in the ballpark of like $500,000 on that scene.
Yeah.
So they wanted to keep it in for budget purposes.
Yeah. And the sponsorship probably like that monster truck was the grandfather of all monster trucks.
Well, they built it for this movie, I'm pretty sure, even, right?
I didn't think so, because it's Bigfoot. So, like, if Bigfoot was created for this movie and became, like,
I think that's how it
reigning,
worked.
Like, the monster truck grandfather of all monster trucks, If so, that's fucking awesome.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's what happened, is that they like had this monster truck commissioned, and then it became, like you said, it went on to become Bigfoot, one of the like most iconic monster trucks of all time. It's wild seeing this monster truck just kind of in the peripherals throughout this movie. I gotta imagine on the cutting room floor, there's like more scenes where they're just driving around in the monster truck, like intimidating people that lead up to that big scene. I guess at the end of the day, I'm not sad that the monster truck scene wasn't cut, but it also is just like one of those scenes where it's like, why is this in here?
Yeah, definitely. I'm surprised we made it this far without bringing up Jimmy.
That's the thing, is that Jimmy also doesn't feel like a character until that scene. Like, he's like one of the henchmen of Brad Wesley.
He's like the final boss before... Yeah. He's like the final henchman. Like, they set him up...
The talented fighter, right?
And yeah, like, I'm trying to place where he first came in. Because we saw him just chilling in the background. Like, the implication was that, like, that's the guy that he's going to have to fight in the end. I'm trying to place exactly where he came in, but he's this like snaky, like dirty fighter. You could tell like he's insane. Like he's an actual psychopath. And that is like heavily implied and shown through, I think, a few scenes. Or it's mostly heavily implied until we get that final scene, which might be jumping ahead. I'm not sure.
We're just shooting the shit right now on the plot. So again, like I almost barely even noticed him until the monster truck scene, where it's like, okay, like this guy is starting to feel like the big bad of the henchmen, right?
Yeah. Because the other henchmen are shown to be incompetent, and like he's the one who's always driving off with the big boss, which I just to say, like the incompetence, like all of the guys get beat up and then they go back, and that's when I think we first get introduced to Brad's like his psychopathy, or like his like badassness, where he just like just punches that guy in the nose again,
right?
Which was great because it really sets up like this guy's just ruthless. He's not afraid to get dirty either, because he was just the rich guy, but then we get kind of introduced to the concept like, oh, he used to be a Jimmy or like a Dalton or like all like in that same realm, kind of,
right? Or a Jackie Treehorn.
Yeah. Not just a Jackie Treehorn in this one, which is great, because like Jackie Treehorn's just a rich guy. This guy, he has some balls to him. Like
there's something menacing in his past that like we don't really want to uncover,
which falls flat in the end a little bit. It's like he only shows it towards anyone he deems beneath him. Like he's cruel to those beneath him. Which, well, again, that shows depth of screenwriting.
Yeah, for sure.
And then he has some dumbass lines, which is great.
I love his one of his secondary introductions of him just like driving down the road, not a care in the world, just like, you know, like weaving in and out of traffic. Like it's such a dumb idea.
Pure entitlement.
Yeah. He just makes things so personal. He basically gives Dalton no out in this. Like he keeps escalating things to the point where it's like, I am going to sacrifice every one of my men or Dalton is going to die.
Yeah.
Anyway, we haven't even really talked about like the introduction of Wade and Sam Elliott's character, because, you know, there's hints at Wade, like he's hinted at in the opening scene, like you said, right?
Yeah, I don't know if I said it here, but like in this episode, but when Tillman shows up, he's like, hey, I want to hire you. You're the best. And then Dalton's like, no, Wade's the best. Why don't we get him? And Tillman's like, he's getting old, man. And Dalton's like, he's still the best. Being humble, but also not humble, because he is pretty fucking badass.
You know, we get the introduction of Wade working at like the strip club or whatever, and he's again that cool, calm, and collected. And you instantly, as soon as we see Sam Elliott's first appearance there, you instantly understand Patrick Swayze's character more, right? Like that's part of the appeal to having this mentor figure, is it helps to explain how this guy has mellowed out to the point where he's at now.
Yeah. And Wade just kind of wants him to stay on that path.
He's the Yoda of this movie.
Yeah. He literally is. He's super old, yet still the youngest we've ever seen Sam Elliott.
Yeah.
Like he's the wise old man who's laid back as well, but can still lay down when he needs to, like lay down the fist and lay down the violence whenever it's required. But he's like, this is the only part of the job. Don't go past the job. And right. Dalton's like, I can't help it this time. And he's like, man, just leave.
Yeah. And like, there apparently was a lot of Sam Elliott scenes that got cut in the final product. Like there was a lot more. Yeah. A lot more of like showing his, like Sam Elliott estimates that at least half of what he filmed was left on the cutting room
floor. Oh, that's sad, man. He was so fucking good.
Yeah. I mean, I think he was just as sad about it as well. So, yeah. But yeah, like it goes into like more of his character and like why he has these kind of ideals and even just like some of his warnings towards Dalton. Like he kind of explains, I think, in some of the cut parts about like him having this girl and like, you know, like he basically went through the same thing as Dalton and lost everything. And he's just kind of like, you know, like you could just walk away from this now kind of thing. Like, and that's kind of even like brought up in this movie as well when he goes to see Dalton and Dalton's like pure like anger kickboxing scene in the barn. Like Wade's at that point trying to talk him down off of that, but again, Brad's just made things so personal that like you could never, you know, walk away from that.
Yeah, Dalton was not super close with Red, but like he felt a connection with Red, and then Red's daughter is who he's kind of dating right now, and then like his place of work, who like he's so prideful, he's so like he's so proud of his work, he's like, I'm gonna turn the double deuce around, and then this guy gets in the way. So it's like he's being attacked on multiple fronts,
and also somehow at some point Brad and Doc were married, I think,
fiance, like engaged, I think.
Yeah
and then it was before she went to get her doctorate.
It's like one of those plot points where it's like, okay, like that one just feels like it was tacked on to like make things feel more personal and give Brad like more characterization and more explanation for why he would have done it. I could have used that without him and her like having been together at some point, because that feels like a stretch to me, but
you know. She was like the prettiest girl in a small town that he moved to. I don't know. I wouldn't say leave it out. I see your point though.
Yeah, Wade comes and they have like him, Doc, and Wade have just a nice night out on the town together. I love that scene because like all of them are just like still absolutely glisteningly gorgeous by the end of that night, even though they've stayed up all night drinking and then gone out for breakfast together. Like, I know for a fact we do not look like that after a night of drinking.
Definitely not. Not you. But yeah, like that was a fun scene because again, like we got so much depth to all of their characters, and Doc gets to see all of where Dalton's like character comes from, and a lot of that comes from Wade, and then she gets, it's like meeting the family.
Yeah. That's exactly it, actually. Yeah, there's something heartwarming about that scene together.
Also the flirtatiousness of Wade to Doc was just great because and like it's because they're like so close that there's no problem between him and Dalton, and it's like he could do that because he's like earned that right kind of, and like, and he's just being playful, he's just a playful man.
Yeah for sure.
So many angles to the characters within such small screen time kind of. Another angle is that why Brad really wants to lay it into Dalton is Denise. We forgot about her.
Well,
it's small.
But that's the thing as well, is right? Like there are points in time where the screenplay is actually even like overwritten.
Oh,
like
yeah.
Adding in Denise at this point too. Like, you know, we've already have the connection with this woman and Dalton and this like love triangle between Dalton and Doc and Brad, and then we also have to throw Denise in, like his new bombshell wife performance, that's like one of the sexiest performances in movies ever. Julie Michaels is just absolute 10.
Yeah,
she's just such an interesting performance too, because we don't even know until like the very closer to the end of the movie that she's even with Brad. Like I didn't even understand or see that connection until like until he shows up at her house or his house.
I don't know at which point Brad and Denise and Jimmy show up at the Double Deuce and like basically close it down.
I'm pretty sure that's after, and
after the monster truck scene.
No, it's not after the monster trucks. It's hard to like follow this movie sometimes as well because some of this stuff doesn't really make a whole lot of sense necessarily. Yeah. Like, the more you talk about this plot, the more nonsensical it becomes.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Once you realize it, like, I feel like it's after the scene where Dalton shows up at Brad's house and she's there doing yoga.
Mm.
After that, they close down the bar.
And that's where we get the first instance of Jimmy versus Dalton. And,
you know,
Denise's sexy dancing and stripping.
Yes, the striptease. This movie is like the epitome of what the bar scene is, because it's about a bunch of very attractive young people partying together with a lot of emotions and like a lot of testosterone and estrogen.
Hormones,
and everything's everything's just flowing. Alcohol's flowing. Tensions are just always just like high, like, and it's constantly
inhibitions
like
low.
Yeah, and like everything's just kind of like fluidly moving between like sexual tension and like outright violence, essentially.
Yeah, which there's such a fine line because how many times in like growing up, like when you're at the bars from like 19 to like 23, like, how many times were there fights just about, like, oh, you're dancing with my girl, stuff like that.
Right.
Like, just such little things will let off, or, like, set off the average person. And especially when egos and alcohol and, like, all those tensions are all come to a peak at the bar, which is so essential to this movie. And they get it right.
Yeah. Again, that scene kind of just like sums this up perfectly, where Denise has her like striptease and then immediately after, Jimmy just goes ham on the entire like bar and the whole bar erupts in a fight again.
And shows like he shows his skill and he almost beats Dalton.
Right. But it's close. It could go either way in that scene. And then after that is when everything starts getting blown up and destroyed, and then they blow up Emmett, the farmer's house, and, you know, we get our final showdown between Jimmy and Dalton. As a side note, did the score of that scene ring any bells to you? So I'm a big score person, and while I was listening to it, there was a movie that I thought of while that scene was playing out, and I Googled it and went, oh my God, they used the same music from a movie that you and I have done on this podcast before.
No way. No, I missed it.
If you listen and pay attention while that scene is playing out, there are structures and even like specific points of the Die Hard soundtrack that are used in that scene.
No way.
Yeah.
Really? Like actually, like bar for bar? Yes. They copied
like
it.
It's the same composer and he just used some extra pieces from the Die Hard track that came out like the year before for this movie. Like while I was watching it, I was like, wait a second, was that the Die Hard like da 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 like thing? And I was right, it actually was.
I love catching those little things.
Yeah, it actually comes around again even in the final fight scene with Brad and Dalton, like in their big scene. They actually play like the Die Hard scene or theme again. That's something to pay attention to next time you watch this movie.
Yeah, I will. So like that whole scene is awesome. Yes. And that's where like if you watch this movie, you'll be like, oh, that's where that line is from. And and that's where that move is from as well, like that kind of stuff.
I used to fuck guys like you in prison is like somehow the most menacing and twisted and also hilarious line I've ever heard.
Yeah, exactly. It's been parodied. It's been copied. It's been overdone like quite a bit since this. But nobody before this would have created this. Like, it only fits within this original Roadhouse movie.
Yeah, 100%.
I can't see them creating a better line for the new one.
I mean, I'm sure at some point we're going to get to hear
Conor McGregor
say that line. And it's going to be like you and I are going to be sitting there like, say the line,
say the line. Yeah. Yeah, no doubt. And then, so like they have their classic fight scene on the beach, which again has been parodied. Then he rips his throat out.
I love how he does like the claw thing and he's just like standing over top of him, like, you know, debating it. And like, you know, for as great as Patrick Swayze is, he's not necessarily the best actor I've ever seen. So like his facial expression of like, do I do this or not? Or doesn't really sell it for me, but I know what he's going for, right? Yeah, like that inner turmoil of like, do I fully embrace my past or should I let this man live kind of thing? Yeah.
And he gave him the old throat rip.
Oh God. Yeah. And then Doc shows up and like checks to see if he's still alive and just completely like, you know, she's just completely horrified by this, right? Like she sees her lover rip another man's throat out.
Yeah. Also Wade gets taken. This whole scene like goes fast. Like there's a lot of shit going on.
And this is, again, this is my least favorite part of the entire script, is just like trying to make sense of the timeline here, because Wade is taken, but we don't really see that. We don't know that Wade's been taken. And so the scene cuts after he screamed at Brad across the water and thrown Jimmy's body into the water floating by. And then he just like drives to the bar, which this like the phone is immediately ringing at this point in time, like as he's walking in. And I'm like, what? Like, what is happening right now? Like, I'm just so confused by all of this. And then it kind of is like semi explained. Like, I rewatched the scene again because I was like, what did I miss here? And it kind of explains it in that, like, Wade, after they have this call and Brad says, well, I'm going to kill either Wade or I'm going to kill Doc.
Yeah.
Heads or tails. Wade is then pushed through the doors because he alludes to the fact that Doc is going to die and that Wade is going to live.
Yeah.
And it's alluded to at that point that they're watching the bar and waiting for him to show up kind of thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is also 1989. Like, is there like a phone booth sitting right there that like somebody's sitting on the phone booth just like waiting for like Dalton to show up so that they can throw Wade in the bar like
and call him?
Like, I don't know. I got a big old problem with that section.
You have to look past certain things. This is old movies.
This is just a bad movie that's really entertaining.
So. yeah, that's true. That's true. And a lot of cuts. They did and so many cuts. And a lot of cuts. We don't know fully what happened there.
But then this is the other thing. It's just like they just let Wade go into the bar and then Dalton leaves and doesn't see anybody there still, even though Wade has just shown up. And then Wade is murdered, like, right after he leaves kind of thing without any sort of protection. Like, none of this makes any sense. But it's a cool scene, right? Like, you know, he has, like, the big mono-y-mono call with the big bad. And then Wade is, like, dumped off and it's implied that Doc is going to be killed. And then it actually, in a very Dark Knight kind of twist, it's actually Doc who survives and Wade who is murdered and with the knife there. And it's like, tails again.
And then
the little detail on that is actually the knife has a coin with a tails on the head of the knife.
Oh, no way. I didn't see that.
I didn't notice it as well, but in my research, it was like, that's kind of what the significance of the heads tails thing is, is that it's always tails. The knife is tails.
Okay. That's great. That's fucking awesome. Like that. It's like the knife is named tails, like swords are named. Yeah.
Tails again. Like, you know, like we slash the tires. We fought you with the knife. Like it kind of keeps popping up kind of thing. Right.
There's so much depth with such a ridiculous concept and movie.
Yeah.
It's like you have so much depth and then you miss so much depth with the cheesy lines and the ridiculous concepts and like a monster truck in the middle of the day.
Yeah.
It's worth watching.
100%. It's so much fun. You know, we're kind of getting to the big climax here, right? And this is like one of the coolest parts of the whole movie is when he just like shoves the knife into the gas pedal and lets the car just like drive into Brad's house. Like that's such an epic scene. And like everybody's here just like blasting it. And the car just like hits off of that little like wall and like flies through the air. And the one guy is like blasting it with a shotgun and blows it up. Like that is one of the coolest scenes in like this movie, period.
Oh yeah, definitely.
It's choreographed very well.
It's like reminiscent of like The Matrix with that highway scene.
Right.
Like it's,
yeah, for sure.
Like it's actually very well done for, again, what this movie is.
Yeah, lots of love for that moment. And then, you know, we get the like nod to like Thief or something like that, where the guy's just like going through the house and like taking people out kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it's so funny because we don't ever really see Dalton take anybody down. Like everybody's just like already dead by the time the knife guy is walking through, right?
Yeah.
It's like, it's kind of one of those things where it's so menacing, and it's like, I think that it's actually, for as much as I have chirped the screenplay, I think it's actually a really good, well-written idea and concept that this character is wandering through this house full of bodies. It's unsettling seeing all of your coworkers murdered like this, and it kind of throws you off. Like, it shows how murderous Dalton can be without having to like also just show Dalton absolutely murder everyone. Because I think also showing Dalton murder every single person would have also made Dalton a little bit of a less sympathetic character too.
Yeah. Because the band of business owners comes in and they're like, oh, I didn't see anything. And then even the guy who got crushed by the polar bear, he's like, nothing here. And like, if we saw him like just murder everyone, and if those people saw him just straight up murder everyone, like just brutally, they'd be like, oh, I don't know, take that guy away and we'll talk after. I don't know.
I have some thoughts on the end before we wrap up this part too. First of all, Brad throwing the spear is like, just makes me want to go spear throwing.
Yeah.
Just like hums through the air like so perfectly.
Yeah. That was awesome.
And then those two fight, like Brad pulls the gun out after their big epic showdown, and it looks like Dalton's in trouble. I explained this to somebody last week. I was like, the movie literally ends with all of the town's businessmen blowing the main character away in like almost like a slow motion scene where he gets shot like 5 times by like shotgun shots.
Like, it's like that Office Space scene where they're just destroying the photocopier, and it's like they're getting all their frustrations out.
And it's just like slow mo, right? Like they like blast him and he kind of like backs away, and it's like, and then he gets back up and he's got the gun again. Yeah. And then it's like, oh my God, what's going to happen? Boom. Like another guy walks in, and then it's like, oh my God, he's still somehow alive and like gunning for Dalton. And then that's when Tilghman shows up and is like, this is our town. Like kind of thing.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so insane. I love that this movie didn't just end there. I love that this movie let us know that everything was going to be all right in the end somehow, and tied this one up for us, right? Because, you know, the cops show up right after this, and the cops are just like, what happened here?
Mm.
And all the businessmen, after having like thrown their guns away, were like, gee, I don't know, this is strange, eh? Like,
yeah.
I didn't see nothing. Did you?
Yeah. And man, like that's happened in real history. Like where like one person in a small town has just been such an asshole their whole life that the whole town is like, I didn't see nothing.
The actual real life person that was based on was Ken McElroy, is the person that you can read about. Like he was called the town bully, and they never solved his killing because everybody in town was in on it.
Yeah, everyone was happy he was gone.
And that's something that like has actually happened throughout human history too, right? Yeah. Like around our parts, like we have the Donnellys, right? Like the Black Donnellys who their entire family were just an absolute nuisance to the town of Lucan, at to the point where like in the 1800s, everybody in that town just like went over to their house one day and murdered all of them.
Yeah. Again, there's depth there.
Somebody put thought into that, and I like that it ends. I like that closure in the film. It's just like, it's so insane.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember what like the very last scene was. Was it like, I just rewatched a little clip of North by Northwest's ending, and like it was just like such a perfect little ending. Like I forget if there was like that like riding off in the sunset or like
triumphant ending kind of things.
We have that like whole the town comes together, everybody's blah blah blah, that
right?
But like what was the final scene, do you remember?
It's almost like a post-credit scene kind of thing. we see like the Double Deuce has been updated, and then Dalton and Doc are having a nice swim together naked.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. That's what I was looking for.
Yeah. We get one last nude scene to wrap the movie up.
Just to nail it home.
Yeah. That's the plot of Roadhouse in a insane, rambling nutshell.
We didn't bring up David Lee Harvey.
Right. Yeah, a lot of... And so we're in effects and filming at this point. You're right. Our Lance Hill, his pen name for the story of this film is David Lee Henry. You kind of have to dig into the details a little bit to figure that out, actually.
Mm.
Yeah, like it's so funny how like some of the best ideas are rooted in real life concepts, right? Or real life ideas that people have.
And he's Canadian. What up?
Nice, nice. Some good Canadian boys in this one. The other effects and filming stuff I want to talk about. Filming of this movie is all in California. This is at the height of like Patrick Swayze's career and like sex symbol in America-ness off the back of Dirty Dancing. And so his actual fame caused problems on set because people would show up on set, like figured out where they were filming this and would show up and try to get into his trailer.
Yeah, like a group of women tried to.
Yeah. The scene on the beach, like the beach fight scene, they actually were interrupted during the fight because a bunch of women had built a raft and
no way
sailing by at that point in time. Yeah, like, and that scene took days to film too, which is, you know, not helped by the fact that like they showed up kind of thing sailing through. And then like there was other extras that would, there was one extra in particular that was playing a waitress. She was so infatuated by Swayze in her scene that she just tripped and spilled all of her drinks on some of the other extras while they were filming. Like,
oh, no way.
it was just chaos brought on by Patrick Swayze's sexiness. Dirty Dancing, there is a connection actually directly to that movie, and it's when Doc and Dalton go back to his place. They play the song These Arms of Mine on the radio, and that's one of the most important scenes as well in Dirty Dancing, in the love scene, I think, too. So
if you put baby in a corner, be nice.
What's wild about this movie, and all of the other wildness, I guess, that I talked about, is like how much the actors actually did their own stunts and kind of all of the training that went on set. Like their trainer was Benny Urquidez, has 9 black belts in 9 different disciplines. Huh. And so he was the primary trainer of everybody on set. He took a really big shining to Patrick Swayze and thought that Patrick Swayze like had legitimate fight chops. Like he was trying to convince Patrick Swayze to go into competitive kickboxing after they finished this movie. That's how like impressed he was. With that, with everybody doing their own stunts and everything, like there was an insane amount of injuries on set. Like Patrick Swayze thought he might die during the making of the movie. Like I'm pretty sure Jimmy broke his ribs while they were fighting on the beach. Sam Elliott had the same deal. Like he said he got the shit kicked out of him the entire movie. You know, there's a lot going on set here. Not a lot of people pulling punches, that's for sure. Swayze had both groins insured for $3 million for the movie.
Both groins?
Both groins, it says. I don't know why it says both groins, but I also don't know anything about the human body, so.
Yeah, like Swayze had to have fluid drained from his knee while filming, as pain did hurt.
Yeah, my favorite effect in filming note, piece of trivia about this movie, is that they had to actually take a break from filming because Swayze thought that he could feel like some bad muscle tightness in his legs. And so the medic team investigated and realized that he had accidentally put on 2 pairs of underpants that day.
How does that happen?
Just, you know, like Patrick Swayze, known for his sexual prowess, not for his underwear putting on abilities.
He puts both pairs on one pair at a time. Just like the rest of us.
Oh god. Oh, during the screening of the movie, Marshall Teague, the guy who plays Jimmy, is like he's a real martial art person. Like, he actually, you know, was one of the primary trainers on set as well.
You can tell that, like, he was better technically than Patrick Swayze, because, like, when Patrick Swayze was doing some of his kicks in that, like, super intense scene at the end where Wade was trying to tell him just leave it alone, and he was all sweaty and stuff, like, some of his kicks just weren't proper. Like, I've done some MMA, and, like, he's not that good technically.
Well, in his defense here, two things. First is that in the scene, it calls for him to be angry and unfocused and undisciplined.
That's true.
And the second is that they could have been filming, like, that could have been take 30 of that scene, right?
Yeah,
and at that point, you're probably getting tired and annoyed anyway. Yeah. I'm throwing the best kicks.
That makes me think, like, could I have kicked his ass if we were both at the same time? He might have been, like, fucking awesome. I don't know.
Jason in his prime and Patrick Swayze in his prime would be an interesting fight. I'm going to be honest. Like, you two would have had a lot to talk about.
It would have been fun.
But yeah, getting back to Marshall Teague and Jimmy. So when they went to the premiere, he brought his mom with him. And so when he says the line, "I used to fuck guys like you in prison," his mother actually jumped up in the theater and shouted, "That's my boy."
Oh, that's perfect. That's awesome. See, that's something that we got from old cinema that we don't get now, I feel like. Like, we're not getting the same, like, there's all these, like, huge stars, and we don't get that kind of insight. That's why I love doing this podcast and, like, finding out these random things that, like, people in the 80s and 90s, 70s, whatever, like, they did.
Part of it.
They were real.
Part of it, honestly, is, and this is something that I've listened to on other podcasts talk about and other pieces of media talk about, is that, you know, if you go back pre-internet age, people just said, like, the craziest shit, because, like, nobody ever expected people to really, like, dig into what they were saying.
Yeah,
and, like, you know, circle back. Like, there wasn't like, an encyclopedia of that kind of stuff being brought up. It's the same thing with, like, for example, like, rock stars. Like, I'm pretty sure back in the day, like, stars like Steven Tyler would talk about, like, having underage girls back in the back of, like, their sets and, like, you know,
their hooking bus up with them and stuff.
Yeah, and like back then, that was not quite acceptable, but it was also kind of just, like, turn a blind eye to because they were rock stars. But also B, like, those guys didn't expect that, like, 30 years later you could just quickly Google that and, like, it would just be on the internet forever kind of thing. So I think that's why you don't get that as much, is that people have kind of built a wall against, like, having anything come back up later to haunt them.
Yeah, and, like, nobody had, like, a intense PR team covering every move that they make and, like, making sure you always look perfect. I love nostalgia overall. That's a huge part of why we watch these movies, is because, like, there was this whole other time. It's a whole other world. And it's just so enjoyable to, like, see that and be like, oh, like, our parents were alive during that time. What did they get up to?
Right. The last kind of effects in filming I do want to talk about is, like, I kind of brought this up earlier, how this movie definitely shares some connections to the Western genre. Most notably, like, the things that have been identified is, so Wade Garrett, his name is related to Pat Garrett, the sheriff who shot Billy the Kid. Brad Wesley, connection to John Wesley Hardin. Doc Holliday. Emmett is named after Emmett Dalton, the leader of the Dalton Gang. The Double Deuce, Tilghman, is named after Bill Tilghman of Dodge City in Oklahoma, who was a lawman at that time. And it just so happens that Dodge City in Oklahoma were nicknamed
Double Deuce?
Something like that. Like the Twin Cities or something like that. Like, This movie has a lot of nods towards that genre. I like when movies have nods towards the Westerns, but aren't, like, necessarily full Westerns in and of themselves. Like, I rewatched Logan recently. Rewatching that movie, as a side note, very, very good superhero movie, but B, like, it's so obvious, like, it wears its inspirations from the Western genre on its sleeve, while also, like, you know, again, being kind of a, like, a superhero film.
Especially when you get, like, Soul Man, who used to be the shit. It's like the young gunslinger goes up against the old gunslinger. There's so many things to compare there, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So the score of the film, I mean, this is a great score, in part because we get the live music from Jeff Healey throughout, which is just fantastic. Patrick Swayze wrote a song and sang a couple songs for the soundtrack, if you ever wanted to track that down, because I think he had like a little like singing
career,
side kind of career. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So he wrote the song Cliff's Edge and then also sang Raising Heaven and Hell Tonight for the soundtrack.
I'll have to re-listen.
And then the composer Michael Kamen also used some musical cues from Die Hard, which again I noticed and was like, did I just hear a Die Hard score piece of that? And I certainly did. Solid score. I really enjoy this one. I like when films can incorporate like live music into their films, and this one probably goes on like a Mount Rushmore of that, honestly.
Yeah, that's fair. I did like, again, it's nostalgia, but like the fashion of the movie. He's just so comfortable, and it's like before the 90s where everyone was wearing like ridiculous stuff again. It's right. it's like an in-between. It is a lot of 80s fashion, but it's also just like this kind of stuff is like timeless classics too, which I really like, except for the mullets, which actually the mullets are back and
they are.
But like not to that degree. You know what I mean? Like, those were, like, pure mullets. Today, it's, like...
Those were, like, the hairspray mullets, right?
Yeah, yeah. Like, today, it's, like, shaved sides mullets. Patrick Swayze hated his hair during this movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is funny, because it was so iconic.
Oh, 100%. So, part of the legacy of this film is, you know, it did okay numbers at the box office. I think it, like, just over doubled its money. But it's since become, like, a cult movie. I think in the past, like, 10 years, within 10 to 15 years after this movie was made, it made, like, something like $200 million just in, like, DVD and, like, VHS sales and syndication. Like, for, like, its budget of, like, some, I don't know, like, 20 or 30 million and then making, like, 60 million at the box office to make, like, $200 million afterwards. Like, this is a pure, unadulterated cult movie in every sense of the word.
Yeah, it's so big in pop culture. Again, what I love about watching all these movies is to see all those references that I grew up with without understanding them.
Yeah, and even at the time, like, this movie was nominated for a bunch of Golden Raspberries because, again, it's not a great movie.
No,
it's so good. Like, it was nominated for Worst Picture, Worst Actor for Patrick Swayze, Worst Supporting Actor, Worst Director, and Worst Screenplay. The only one I agree with there is the screenplay is awful, and everything else is so good that it makes it work. It's considered one of the best good, bad movies of all time, because it is.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last piece of trivia I have here is Bill Murray, apparently every time he watches this movie on syndication, calls up his buddy Mitch Glazer, who's a film producer who just so happens to be Doc Kelly Lynch's wife, our husband, and just ribs him about how much Kelly Lynch is portrayed in this film.
Yeah. How much of her, yes.
So,
classic.
Just a classic Bill Murray-ism connection to this movie. So, personal reviews and The Partner Factor. I guess I've said this multiple times throughout this, one of the best good, bad movies. Like, it's always a blast to watch this one. I could probably put this on just about any time and get hooked into it. Because the plot is the way that it is, you could probably, like, this is probably why this movie has done so well, is because in the years that it would have been syndicated on TV, it's just so easy to pop in at any point in time because the plot doesn't really matter. It's just like the set pieces and the characters and the vibe of the movie is just like strong enough to pull you in at really any point and just keep watching to the end kind of thing.
I'm kind of surprised there weren't like more big 80s hits within the movie because it's such like a classic 80s movie. know what I mean? Like, I'm glad it has its score how it is and everything, but like, it makes me think of like a bunch of 80s songs. It fits into the comfort of the 80s, know what I mean? Like,
yes, it does, in a sense. Like, I've been reading Quentin Tarantino's book, and then I watched like a really good video essays about why the 80s in filmography suck so much. This is kind of like on the end of that period of time, but it does still kind of it does still fall into the tropes of the 80s. I can't remember exactly. I think it's called, it's something like High Octane Cinema but it's basically like this film subgenre or writing style of a film where there's always a character who has a mentor. There's always like a piece of romance. There's always like the character always succeeds at the end. Like, there's this whole like arc of a story that every 80s movie kind of sticks to.
Right. Yeah.
That this movie is also kind of a victim of. And not to say that like this movie isn't fun to watch and other movies of that are fun to watch, but it would be like, it's pretty comparable to now, right? Of like the 2010s of like,
yeah,
you know, after so many superhero movies, you kind of get the superhero movie, right?
Like, yeah.
I don't need to see another superhero movie. I could probably explain the plot of the last Ant-Man movie to you, having seen nothing but a 2-minute trailer.
Yeah, exactly. But again, it's the nostalgia.
Yeah, exactly. Like, and Jess likes this movie a lot too. Like, we have a lot of fun every time we watch this. It's just a silly, fun movie.
Yeah, I don't think I could pull Annabelle into this one. Either timing or she just really wasn't into it. I talked to her about the movies just in like a mad splattering of all of my thoughts, which she gets a lot of, but she knew that it wasn't like right for her, because like some of it, it's just like too all over the place and just kind of ridiculous.
Right.
Yeah, so I don't really have like a good partner factor for her, but I'd say this would be on the lower end for her. But it's definitely okay. It's definitely on the higher end for me.
I mean, this is never going to end up in any like top 100 list or anything like that, but it is just a really fun movie. And that's like, ultimately, if a movie can succeed at being fun and being entertaining and like, I enjoy it, and at the end I felt like the movie earned its time. Like, I can't, you know, like, I'm not going to harp on it. Like, I did a bit on the screenplay and stuff, but like, you know, at the end of the day, I'm not going to say I didn't enjoy a movie after having so much fun with it for 2 hours, right?
Yeah. If you look at new movies that you just throw on for fun, this is better.
This movie is almost like a pre-streaming kind of film, in that it's not very good, but it's trying to be something for everyone.
Yeah.
However, it ultimately succeeds where 100% of those movies fail.
Yeah. How many movies do you just throw on because it looks fun? Like, you're feeling like a fun vibe. You want to watch something new and you'll never really remember it. Like, I just watched this John Cena movie and what's his name?
John Cena. Ricky Stenicki?
Yeah, Ricky Stenicki. So I just watched that. I'm probably not going to remember that like next month or ever again. But like, it was a fun throw it on, whatever, but it had no like substance, no holding power, whereas these kind of movies do, because at the time they like were pervasive and they like had some kind of staying power. They became a cult classic. Very few movies in our time so far, like, there are cult classics and there's going to be more than we know, of course. Like, we're looking at these times without the lens of time. But like, for example, like Ricky Stenicki, not going to have staying power.
Well, and that's the other like problem with streaming, right? Yeah. Is that like things get lost in the ocean of content.
Yeah.
You know, again, like you said, like, time is going to be the ultimate deciding factor on what movies end up gaining cult status and which ones don't. But it's a little harder now because there's just so much out there. I'll say though, on the flip side of that, is that 2023, we got a lot of really good movies. Like, I'm just wrapping up the watching all of the top 10 movies that were Best Picture nominations, And for the most part, they've all been really goddamn good.
Yeah.
I actually think that Oppenheimer's my least favorite of the 10 Best Picture nominations that I've watched so far.
I would assume that. I don't know how many I've watched. Past Lives, is that in there?
It is. It was great. Loved Past Lives.
Yeah, me too.
The Holdovers is probably one of my favorite movies now of 2023. I just watched that like last week.
That might have staying power, yeah.
I think The Holdovers is going to be the movie of 2023 with the most staying power. I think I watched that movie with Jess and was like, that's an instant classic.
Oh, yeah.
That was one of the best movies like ever, basically. But yeah, like Poor Things is fantastic.
I want to watch that.
It'll be interesting to see like what of those maybe become cult classics. Like, yeah, they were nominated for Best Picture, but they're also all somewhat a little bit more obscure to like the average moviegoer, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, I think we're getting to a long point in our podcast, and I think we want to wrap this episode up now. So
I just have one last question. Could you imagine us when we were like, let's say 21 in Roadhouse, like who would be what? Like, how awesome would it have been to have that kind of experience with all of us?
I mean, I think everybody goes through a bit of a rite of passage in their early 20s, like, and lived some kind of crazy life, right? So yeah,
we would have fit in.
Yeah, we certainly experienced some amount of the insanity of this film. I haven't got my monster truck yet, though, so.
I don't know. I wouldn't have necessarily been Jimmy. I don't know if I would have been Dalton, but, like, fucking, I would have been one of the crazy motherfuckers.
You still are in my heart, but, yeah, especially back then, for sure. All right, we should wrap this puppy up.
Yeah.
I'm excited. We haven't watched the new Roadhouse at the time of recording this, so I'm excited to see the new one and what it does with the mythology of this film.
Yeah, it's going to be good. At least just for comparison's sake and to see how, like, I would love to see a remake crush it. And I want it to be this one.
Yeah, that's fair. All right, we'll see you next time when we're doing, I think Mike and I are doing Watership Down next.
Oh, nice.
Which I'm looking forward to. Yeah. And tell your dad.
Yes.
Or your uncle, I guess. Tell your uncle.
Yeah, tell your uncle. That's exactly right for this one.
See you next time.